Hello and welcome to Everyone Special and No One Is, a podcast about obscure, misunderstood, and or controversial topics related to music. Good morning, Mom.
Good morning, Martin.
How are you feeling?
I'm great.
We are continuing our exploration of the evolution of synth pop from the Beatles to Whitney Houston. Last time we talked all about the birth, death, and rebirth of disco music.
Yeah, I didn't know about the rebirth.
Yeah.
I didn't even know how it died.
Right, exactly. And today we're going to be getting into what happened immediately after the death of disco music in 1979. We're going to be talking about the second British invasion. There were all these British artists making predominantly synthesized electronic pop music that was then becoming popular in the United States in the early 80s.
Yeah.
Yeah, because the first British invasion, as you know, is like the Beatles, the Rolling Stones. That was the mid-60s when all of these rock bands from the UK started becoming popular in America. But the second British invasion, which is maybe not frequently given as much press, but it was in the beginning of the 80s.
Yeah, and it was electronic.
Not 100% electronic, but heavily
influenced by electronic.
Exactly. And since we're finally getting into 80s music, that means that I finally get to ask you the question, Mom, where were you in the 80s?
I was checked out. I always say this. I was in California geographically. And for some reason, I was starting my career and very distracted by enough that I wasn't very much in the music scene.
What year did you graduate college?
Graduated from college in 1981, went out to the West Coast, and I was doing all sorts of stuff other than listening to music.
So how would you rate your familiarity with 80s pop culture in general?
I've always said not at all, quite oblivious.
On a scale of 1 to 10?
Well, I give me a 1, but you've played some stuff for me, and it's like, oh, okay. No, I'm sorry. In retrospect, give me a 4.
Okay. Because you recognized, we listened to Video Killed the Radio Star at the end of the last episode. You recognized that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So like I said, we're finally getting into the 80s. We're getting into British music, which ended up invading American pop culture in the 80s. But like anything else, in order to explain a movement, you have to talk about what led up to that movement in the years prior to it. So we're actually still going to be talking a little bit about what was going on at the end of the 70s in order to fully understand what happened at the beginning of the 80s.
Okay.
So let's go back 1977. How old were you in 1977?
17.
And how long had you been playing the piano in 1977?
10 years.
So can you imagine how your life would be different if you were still the same age, born around the same time, but instead of the piano being your first instrument, what if your first instrument was a synthesizer?
Yeah, that would be put me in a different place.
It turns out that the reason for the way electronic music evolved the way it did was the first wave, you had artists like Pink Floyd, Stevie Wonder, Keith Emerson of Emerson, Lake & Palmer. You had these artists that were already coming from like your background of being really, really good at playing the piano. And then they were applying their piano skills to the synthesizer. But with this new generation, they were actually growing up not having a lot of prior musical training, not really knowing how to play the piano very well. And they just get a synthesizer as their very first instrument.
Yeah.
So one of these artists that were growing up around this time, they were cutting their teeth on music in the mid to late 70s, was the Human League. Have you ever heard of the Human League?
I think I've heard of them.
Yeah, so they were originally formed in 1977. They were based in the UK. So we're going to listen to a little clip from the BBC documentary Synth Britannia, and we're going to listen to Philip Oakey, the lead singer of the Human League, talking about the origin story of the band.
The day that I joined the band, Martin came around to my house and he had two records under his arm. One was Trans Europe Express and one was I Feel Love. And he said, look, we can do this. I think that was his actual phrase. I I feel that just didn't sound like any record that had been before. It came on the radio and you couldn't quite believe what you were hearing.
So they were actually inspired by I Feel Love by Donna Summer, a disco song.
Yeah.
And not just any disco song, but one of the most forwardly electronic disco songs.
Yeah, and it was such a hit.
Yeah, and the other album that he just mentioned was the Trans Europe Express by Kraftwerk. Kraftwerk was a synthesizer band from Germany, and they were influential to a wide amount of different artists, including the Human League. We're going to listen to the Trans Europe Express by Kraftwerk.
Got it.
Trans Europe Express. Trans Europe Express.
So what do you think of that?
That is not hit material, in my opinion. Was that a hit?
It was a hit. The Trans Europe Express by Kraftwerk.
That was a hit.
It was a hit.
Sounds like somebody learning how to play the synthesizer.
It was very successful. You want to know how successful that album was? So the Trans Europe Express reached number 32 on the Germany chart. And in the UK, it reached number 49.
Wow.
So it wasn't a massive hit. But it was commercially successful.
Yeah, I'm really surprised.
Another part of the reason why Kraftwerk was particularly popular in the UK is because there was another very, very prominent artist in the UK that was sort of sharing their music a lot, playing their albums before his own concerts. It was David Bowie.
Oh, okay.
David Bowie was a huge Kraftwerk fan. Okay. To the point where in the Trans Europe Express, they're actually specifically calling out meeting David Bowie in the lyrics.
Interesting.
Back to Düsseldorf City, meet Iggy Pop and David Bowie.
Well, you get a promoter like David Bowie, and sure.
Exactly. So anyway, so the Human League, they were founded in 1977 as a band, and they were strongly influenced by Kraftwerk and Donna Summer. They decided that they were going to create music that was specifically electronic music, and they made a manifesto for their band at the very, very beginning. And are you ready to hear a paraphrased version of their manifesto?
Yeah.
First, we will only use electronic instruments.
Oh my.
No guitar, no drums, no bass, only electronic music. And second, we will not use any bland words in the lyrics at all. No cliches, no nothing, just interesting words. And in particular, we will not use the word love in our lyrics.
Too many love songs.
Exactly.
Wow, okay.
So you have a band that's founded on the premise that they're going to be an electronic band and they're not going to use any traditional instruments. Part of the reason why they were inspired to do that is because Brian Eno, a synthesizer player and producer who had worked with David Bowie, had published an article talking about this new philosophy surrounding electronic music. So we're going to listen to Martin Ware, another founding member of the Human League, talking about his impression of reading this Brian Eno article.
There was an article in New Musical Express, which was the most popular paper, music paper in Britain at that time. And they were kind of taste leaders. And there was a double-page article with Brian Eno. The article said, "Rock and roll is dead. It's old-fashioned. Don't need guitars anymore. All you need is a microphone, a synthesizer, and a tape machine."
Brian Eno said all you need is a synthesizer, a tape machine, and a microphone. So they took him literally.
I'm so curious to learn whether this was successful. I'm hoping not.
So yeah, so Martin Ware, a founding member of the Human League, buys a Korg monophonic synthesizer. At the time, the price was £350. This is in the UK. This is the year 1977. When you do the math to try and get some sort of a comparison for the price that would be in today's dollars in America, I did the math and it's roughly $3,000 of today's US dollars, which remember when we did the same price conversion for the Mini Moog, we found that the Mini Moog was going for around today's equivalent of $9,000 US dollars. at its release. So you compare this newer, cheaper Korg instrument, which is about the price of what you could expect an electric guitar to cost at the time, and it's much more accessible.
But it's still monophonic. And that strikes me as very limiting.
Yeah, because monophonic means you can only play one single note at a time.
Right, so $3,000, is that what you said?
Yeah, today's equivalent in USD.
Right, $3,000 to play one note at a time strikes me as limiting.
So Martin Ware buys this Korg synthesizer, and it's still pushing his budget because, as he says later in this interview...
I remember distinctly thinking at the time, I was a computer operator, and there was a decision day where it was either buy a second-hand car and learn to drive, or go and buy this monophonic synthesizer. And that proved to be quite a fateful day, because I still can't drive, but I still got that synthesizer.
That is a great quote. I love that.
Right. So that is Martin Ware of the Human League. And the original lineup of the band, you have Martin on synthesizers. You have Ian on synthesizers. You have Phil Oakey on vocals. No other instruments required, just synthesizers and vocals. And they just had to keep recording and re-recording parts and putting them all into their inexpensive little tape machine. And the result was their first single, which is called Being Boiled. You ready to hear Being Boiled by the Human League?
I'm not sure.
This was released in 1978. So this is what you get when you start a band with the premise that you're going to use nothing but electronic instruments and the human voice.
Just because the kid's an orphan is no excuse for thoughtless slaying. Children don't forget this torture. Just because you call her mother doesn't mean that she's your better.
That was kind of painful for me.
What?
Sorry.
Painful.
They didn't even try to have a violin. I mean, with a synthesizer, you could create an orchestra that sounds very much like an orchestra. You can have the sound of real stuff, right? And they really went all out with electronic sound.
This is the new thing. Why do you have to pretend to be something else that already exists when you can innovate? It's the new frontier.
Yeah, I get
synthesizers.
That.
Synthesizers. Yeah. So do you think this song was a big success?
I'm guessing it wasn't.
It was not, sadly. It did receive mixed reviews in the press, and it did not go on to really make them famous. And beginning in the early days of the Human League, it was kind of volatile. There was a lot of, oh, we're going to do this. No, we're not going to do this going on. So that was their first single, but it was not released on their first album. It was actually re-recorded and re-released on their second album. Their first two albums, they did chart. So it wasn't like it was just totally weird and no one listened to it. There were definitely people listening to their music, but it was not like the top of the charts by any stretch. Their first album released in 1979. It peaked at number 34 in the UK charts. Their second album, Travelogue, in 1980, peaked at number 16. So that's pretty okay.
I am very curious about this, because though I didn't like that song, this is a part of the beginning of this second British invasion, mm-hmm. and the Brits becoming very into electronic music. So it's very interesting,
yeah,
if not enjoyable.
When you have like a synthesizer that you can only play one note at a time on, and you need to create a full fleshed out sounding song, you can't just have two people playing keyboards and make that a full performance. You need a lot more. You need to use pre-recorded tracks. But at the time, this was controversial.
Well, so it was wise of them to be upfront and honest about that.
So I wanted to share with you another clip from the podcast Totally 80s. In this clip, the host, Lindsay Parker, is interviewing Martin Ware from the Human League, talking about performing live.
With the early Human League, we said, how the hell are we ever going to perform this live? We can't afford to employ four or five synthesizer players. like you would have a band with a bass player and a guitar and a drummer. Right. We just couldn't afford it. It was an economic thing, and it would have looked ridiculous anyway. So we said, look, we just got to be honest and say some of this is pre-recorded. On stage, we had a reel-to-reel tape recorder. And at the start of every early Human League gig, we'd come on, and the first thing we'd do is switch the tape recorder on.
That's kind of punk rock, actually. That's funny because that probably caused controversy then, but like nowadays, no one bats an eye at anything being on tracks or whatever.
Yeah, we got attacked in Germany physically.
No way.
We did this, and one of the audience members started burning a Union Jack. Then they started throwing things, some objects and stuff, and then people started storming the stage, and we're going to get killed.
Oh,
and this
was
all because we weren't a rock and roll band.
Wow.
Isn't that kind of scary?
It is. People get really emotionally involved in music. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm thinking now about that Disco Demolition disaster.
Yeah.
Right? People get very emotionally involved.
Exactly. Yeah. Burning records, attacking musicians because it doesn't fit what they think, what the audience thinks music is quote unquote supposed to be.
Yeah.
Pretty wild, right?
Very.
Do you want to hear the lead single from their second album, Travelogue?
Sure, yeah. That was much better. That got me about 70% of the way there. But what I'm noticing in both of these that just really stands out for me is both of them lack depth.
Mm-hmm.
They're very thin and they're dealing with this monophonic device and they don't have the richness of a band,
mm-hmm.
right? It's very thin.
It's very stripped back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I think is part of the problem.
In my opinion, what's interesting about this one is you see it's more in a commercially packaged format.
Yeah.
You know, Being Boiled, their first single that we listened to before this was just weird.
Yeah.
You know, it's just weird for the sake of being weird. But this is like, okay, can see how it's kind of catchy. You could sing along to it.
Yep.
Could dance to it.
Yep.
The Wikipedia page on this song is really interesting. Only After Dark. The song was pressed as a single by Virgin Records following the release of the Travelogue album, but then it was decided to re-release the song Empire State Human from the band's first album instead and include Only After Dark as a free single to be given away with the first 15,000 copies of Empire State Human. This was perceived by the band as a total lack of faith in their newer material, causing great resentment and anger, and would be one of the issues that contributed to the split up of this lineup of the Human League some months later.
Interesting.
So it's like, we're going to put out your new song from your new album, but we're going to include the song from your old album. And the new one is just a free bonus promo for some reason. And they didn't like it. And there were other, of course, creative differences, different ways that they viewed the band would evolve. So Martin and Ian and Philip ended up splitting up. Martin and Ian went off on their own to do their own thing, and Philip retained the rights to the name The Human League and brought in new musicians, in particular, two singers.
Did Martin and Ian end up using traditional instruments?
They did not stick religiously to the manifesto that they created at the beginning of their band.
Before they broke up? Like, even The Human League didn't?
I'm not sure how long the manifesto was intact. But it may have ended when they broke up. It may have ended before or after that. I'm not sure.
Okay.
Yeah, so they recruited Joanne Catherall and Suzanne Sully on vocals and went on to release an album that would become one of the most popular albums of the early 80s and, more importantly, one of the breakout synth pop albums of the 80s called Dare. And the lead single from the album Dare is Don't You Want Me, which I'm curious to see if you've heard this song before. You were working as a waitress in a cocktail bar. You remember that song?
Oh, totally. Yes, absolutely.
Well, it was released at the end of 1981, but it became popular in the U.S. in 1982. And that single, Don't You Want Me, ended up selling over 1.5 million copies in the U.K. alone, making it one of the most popular U.K. singles ever. And also was massively popular in America. Don't You Want Me, on the Billboard chart, it peaked at number one and stayed in that position for 3 weeks. So it was popular long after its release. And you can tell still throughout all of these songs that we've listened to by the Human League, they're not great keyboard players, you know?
I'm not sure they're great vocalists. But they but they put together a great song.
Yeah. Yeah. So actually, in order to go on tour for their album Dare to capitalize on its success, they needed to hire a new keyboard player because the people that were in the band at the time were not good enough. The lead singer, Phil Oakey, mentioned that for the first 4 years of the band's existence before the success of Dare, no one was able to even play the keyboard with two hands.
They don't have to. They've got a monophonic device. You'd think they could go take piano lessons.
At what age do you think you started playing piano with two hands, Mom?
8 or 7.
Yeah, so they ended up, they did get a keyboard player who could play with both hands. I think what's notable here in the transition from the kind of commercial music, the pop and rock music that had synthesizers in the early 70s, you have these really, really great musicians. You have Stevie Wonder, you have Keith Emerson of Emerson, Lake & Palmer, you have Wendy Carlos, you have all these people who are really great at playing the piano that are now playing the synthesizer, so they're playing really complicated stuff on the synthesizer. But in order for electronic music to evolve, you had to have these unskilled, untrained musicians playing on cheaper instruments, creating a much more dumbed down sound that was therefore more accessible and more catchy. Because if you're not able to play all these virtuosic whatever, then you're going to play simpler melodies, which are going to be more memorable and are going to last in people's brains longer.
Interesting.
So the Human League was just one of many UK-based artists that got really popular in the UK and also enjoyed success in other countries, including the US, part of the second British invasion. And I wanted to give a little sampling of other artists as well. We're not going to go as in depth as we did the Human League and these other artists, but I think it's important just to give a little taste of who else was in this scene contributing to this movement of electronic pop music out of the UK so that we can then understand what came after that.
Cool.
And first up on the list, have you heard of Gary Numan?
Apparently not, unless I'm confusing it with some other Newman.
Okay, so you know who does know about Gary Numan, or at least knows slightly more about Gary Numan than you know about Gary Numan?
My husband.
Yes.
Gary Numan is somebody that I know I should know something about, but that I don't know anything about. But whenever I hear people talking about influential artists and music, that name comes up quite a bit.
Okay. Say he knows nothing but knows of him.
So Gary Numan was originally a part of the post-punk band called Tubeway Army before making a name for himself as a solo artist and also moving away from punk music and into the realm of synth pop music. There's a clip from this Synth Britannia documentary I want to share of how Gary Numan originally transitioned away from punk into synth music and what sort of inspired him to do that.
So we're in the UK.
Yes, still. We're still in the UK.
In the corner of the studio, there was a mini Moog. Luckily, it had been left on this sound, which is a huge, big, bassy thing. And the room shook. I just realized you can just press one key and all this other stuff happens. There was a massive amount of power in them and depth that I just never heard anything like it before.
So he just found a mini Moog synthesizer, which was left over from the previous session. And he was like, oh, let's make electronic punk music instead of purely guitar-driven punk music, basically.
Yeah.
And he does, in this clip, say Mini Moog.
Yeah, I heard
that. Is the incorrect pronunciation. Technically, it's Moog, but whatever.
It looks like Moog.
It does.
If you look, it looks like Moon.
Yeah.
Moog.
Anyway, so the song that was playing along with that clip, which we'll listen to just by itself right now, was his single Our Friends Electric, and this was released in May 1979. You like it?
Not that much. Yeah, just not my style. Okay, so but he goes on to become great in some way.
So this single, along with his subsequent single as a solo artist, his single Cars was also, both of these singles were massively successful in the UK. They were both number one hits on the UK charts. So we're going to listen to Cars. You recognize the song?
Totally. This one I know.
Yeah. Here in my car, I feel safest of all. I can lock on my doors. It's the only way to live in cars. You like this song?
It's okay. It's not on the top of my list for sure.
But you've heard it many times.
I've heard it. Yeah. It was apparently a hit over here.
Yeah.
On this side of the pond.
Exactly. So unlike Our Friends Electric, Cars was also a hit in the U.S. It was also Gary Numan's only significant hit in the U.S., but in the U.K. he had a lot more traction. But what's really interesting about Gary Numan and the why, like in the clip from Ken talking earlier that we heard, Gary Numan gets referenced so much because he was on the forefront of that, the movement in the UK of making more synthesized pop music. While the Human League, at the same time in late 78, 79, early 1980, they were struggling to find their footing, struggling to get big commercial success. Gary Numan was at the top of his game in the summer of 1979, and it caused actually a huge spur of interest in record companies that now wanted to invest more heavily in this electronic music. This is like the music of the future. We're going in this more electronic leaning way, and it's the new thing. We have to find more people like that. But the irony of it was that Gary Numan actually believed for a while that he was the first person to make music like this. It's like, I am the original synth pop artist. Until later, in the wake of the success of these songs, he started finding out, oh, there were a lot of other people in the UK around the same time that were also investing in comparatively more affordable synthesizers that were also making heavily synthesized music. So it wasn't just him, but in the beginning, he thought it was.
That is interesting. That, you know, it's interesting how there are other times in history where people have discovered or invented the same thing at the same time, completely independently.
Mm-hmm. So for Gary Numan, the fact that his success caused other record companies to invest elsewhere, a similar thing happened. Remember we talked about Switched on Bach with Wendy Carlos creating this classical crossover album. And what happened there was that all these other record companies started making albums like Switched on the Beatles, Switched on Nashville, Switched on Santa, and most of those records failed. But the difference here is that there is this huge spur of interest in electronic music, but rather than this strictly like, oh, we're going to take pre-existing music and flip it and make it electronic, these are all these bands that are making original music. It's their own thing, it's new, and it did actually pay off in this case.
Yeah.
Yeah. So some would argue that Gary Numan paved the way for artists like the Human League to be successful, even though the Human League were doing it earlier than he was, because he was successful first. it kind of opened the door for more electronic artists to emerge.
It's interesting that he's got such a big name, I guess, over here. Now, I didn't know what he was famous for.
Yeah. So another artist I wanted to briefly highlight was Eurythmics. Eurythmics was a duo consisting of Dave Stewart on synthesizers and Annie Lennox on vocals. And their biggest song was Sweet Dreams Are Made of This, which was released in 1983. I'm wondering if you've heard this song before.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Totally. Oh yeah. Oh, I love this. Totally. And the seven seas. Everybody's looking for something. Some of them want to use you. Some of them want to get used by you. Some of them want to abuse you.
This must have hit the top of the American charts for quite a while.
Yeah, this song was a huge hit in both the UK and in the US. It hit number one in the US and number two in the UK.
Two? Really?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. This was number one. Yeah.
Huge, huge, huge successful song. And fun fact about the production of this song, this is actually turned into the stuff of legend, but we're going to listen to an artist from another band called Ultravox talking about the story of how Eurythmics recorded A Sweet Dreams Are Made of This.
You've got to remember that it was the first time ever that someone could sit and make a record on their own. Eurythmics came along and they did, I remember, they did Sweet Dreams in the basement. You know, they recorded it on an 8-track tape machine. Annie sang Sweet Dreams into a little Shure microphone, holding it in her hand, you know, and won a Grammy for it.
Good. They should have won a Grammy for that one.
Yeah, and he just said it was recorded on a Shure microphone. You know what microphone you're using right now?
Oh, a Shure?
Yeah.
Okay, there we are.
Yeah, so...
in their basement.
Right, so this song, along with other songs in this movement, you know, we talked about how the Human League was a very DIY project at the beginning, kind of paved the way for DIY musicians that now to this day, really all you need to make music is just a little 2-octave keyboard, which is pretty cheap, and a laptop, you know, then just some basic recording software and you're good to go.
If you've got vocals, you need a microphone.
And a microphone, yeah. So it's like what Brian Eno predicted in like 1976 may not have been totally true at the time, but it has now manifested itself and that's actually all you need.
We got there.
Yeah. The last band I wanted to highlight was Simple Minds. They are a band from Scotland. They were originally a 5-piece lineup. They also sort of emerged out of this punk background. They had a different band name, but later changed their name to Simple Minds, shifted into making synth pop music. Their debut song, released in 1979, is called Life in a Day. Ever heard this song before?
Not that I know of.
So if there's a Simple Minds song which you might recognize, it would probably be Fast Forward All the Way to 1985. And this is the song Don't You Forget About Me.
Don't you forget So apparently Simple Minds decided that they did need to bring in some traditional instrumentation.
Well, yeah, because they were actually a band before they started playing synthesizers, as opposed to the Human League, which was formed around the premise of using only electronic instruments.
Right.
Do you know what movie this song was in?
No.
This was used in the movie The Breakfast Club.
Which I never saw.
An iconic 1985 classic movie.
Adding it to my movie list.
So, Don't You Forget About Me by Simple Minds went to number one on the US charts. It was very, very, very popular, particularly because of the movie as well. And yeah, just this random Scottish rock band that decided to play the synthesizer.
What's interesting about this to me is this is the second British invasion. And I know a lot of this music, but none of the artists' names. I don't remember ever hearing of the Human League? The Human League.
Simple Minds.
Any of these guys.
Gary Newman.
Well, that name I had heard.
You had heard of Gary Newman, but you didn't associate Gary Newman with the Cars song, which you recognize. Right,
totally no Cars.
Yeah.
Even by name.
So I just think it's really interesting. So in the second British invasion, when it really came to fruition was around 1982, 1983. In 1983, the popularity of British artists in America, by some measures, actually rivaled the success of the original British invasion in 1965.
Seriously?
Yeah. So out of all U.S. record sales in the year of 1983, an estimated 30% of those record sales were by British artists.
Can you name for me like the top four or five of those British artists?
Yeah. So The Police at the top of the list, which is funny because they are not electronic. You know, The Police is just a rock band. They played reggae-influenced rock music, but they may have played synthesizers a few times, but they're not really known as a synth-pop band in the same way that the Human League is. But some really, really popular British invasion artists that were electronic were, aside from who we already talked about, Gary Newman, The Human League, Simple Minds, some others would be Depeche Mode, Duran Duran. Those names mean anything to you?
Duran Duran, yes.
Soft Cell?
Nope.
Japan, Joy Division, New Order, Ultravox, Yazoo.
Ultravox I've heard of.
Yeah, and there is not time to listen to music from all of those artists.
Yeah.
Because this is a podcast, but yeah, I just think it's really fascinating that all of this British music became so popular in the US and then also inevitably encouraged US artists to start making music that mirrored some of this British music, and they all just influenced each other.
Yeah, but 30% of record sales being British artists, that is significant.
It is significant.
Really cut into the American market.
Yes. And you know how that happened? The single biggest factor, arguably, that caused British artists in 1983 to become so massively popular in the US?
No.
MTV.
Oh, MTV.
It's all to blame on MTV.
Was MTV British based?
No, MTV was a US
I thought so.
Television show that showed exclusively music video content. And it was massively popular, and they showed a lot of British music. We'll be getting into all of that in the next episode to explain how MTV sort of ignited US interest in British music and then kind of led into Whitney Houston. We'll be finally talking about Whitney Houston, which has been sort of the end goal of this entire podcast series.
Okay, one note. What you were just saying is all of this is what led into Americans being interested in the British music or in
British synth pop.
British synth pop. I challenge that it's the music they were making more than the loving the artists themselves.
Yeah.
It's the music that was being made.
Yeah.
Just so happens that music was being made out of Britain.
Yeah. You ready to get into it? MTV and Whitney Houston in the age of synth pop of the 80s?
I am looking forward to that conversation.
Yeah, it's going to be the last one.
Yeah.
That's so sad.
Yeah.
Well, thanks so much, Mom, for...
Very fun.
Yeah. Was it surprising how much of this music you recognized?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Not knowing it was from Britain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's the second British invasion. Next week, we'll talk about MTV, which kind of explains how all this music took off in the US. And finally, Whitney Houston.
Okay.
All right.
Can't wait.
See you then.
See you next week.
Can you say your catchphrase? Your catchphrase that you said at the end of every episode? You don't remember your catchphrase? Mom, talk to me. Say something.
Until next time?
No, that's my catchphrase.
See ya again?
No. You forget your catchphrase?
Uh-huh.
What?
I'm embarrassed.
Starts with the word bye.
Bye for now?
Yes, thank you. You forgot that was your catchphrase?
Apparently.
You'd just been unintentionally saying that?
Yes. Absolutely.
Okay, I'm going to say my catchphrase and then you say your catchphrase. Are you ready?
Got it.
Until next time.
Bye for now.
Thanks so much for listening and for making it this far into the series. As I mentioned, next week's episode will be the last episode of Synthesized. As always, there is a link in the description of this episode with a resources sheet. The resources for this episode include a link on YouTube to the Synth Britannia documentary that we watched clips of in this episode, as well as the podcast featuring Martin Ware of the Human League. There's also a list of songs that we listened to in this episode in that resources sheet as well. Thanks so much to my friend Bobby Rethwich for allowing me to use his songs Let's Forget This Ever Happened and I've Been Meaning to Ask You as the beginning and ending theme music of this podcast. All right, that's all. Until next time, we'll see you in the last episode of Synthesized next week. Well, I've been